This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we've got a physics expert who can help turn your tough sledding into fast, frictionless fun on your next trip to a snowy hill. Now, the highly infectious Omicron variant of COVID-19 has spread across the country just as schools are coming back from winter break. Take a listen to U.S. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona on Fox News earlier this week.
You know, we've been very clear. Our expectation is for schools to be open full-time for students, for in-person learning.
The majority of districts nationwide are reopening in person, but across the country, over 3,000 schools announced that they are either going virtual to start the year or bumping back in-person school, including some districts in Wisconsin. And schools with in-person learning in many cases are trying to stay safe with widespread testing, which brings challenges of its own. We're talking about how schools are coping as the country is hit with another wave of COVID cases, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Students, staff, teachers, and parents, we especially want to hear from you. What is happening right now in your district? Are you back in person? Were you bumped back a day or two? A little bit of virtual on the way? And what do you think of that decision, whichever one it is? What challenges are you seeing when it comes to staffing, to testing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. John Diamond is a professor of sociology and education policy at Brown University, a former professor at UW-Madison. He's co-author of Despite the Best Intentions, How Racial Inequality Thrives in Good Schools. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you have your eye here in Wisconsin still, I think. What are we seeing in Wisconsin schools when it comes to this decision of opening day coming out of the winter break?
Yeah, I mean, I think Wisconsin is dealing with the similar issues to the rest of the country with the Omicron variant spreading so quickly. I know both Madison and Milwaukee have put a pause on starting up in-person instruction and gone virtual for a short period of time. And I think it's, you know, largely because we're dealing with a situation where we don't really have many good choices. I think schools are dealing with, you know, at least three issues simultaneously. It's the pandemic itself and the health consequences of it. It's, you know, what that does for the daily routines of schools. And then there are the politics that have made things even more difficult to deal with. So I think we're dealing with those health concerns, those regular routines being disrupted and having to adapt in the moment. And then there are the political dynamics that play themselves out in the context of schools in ways that are not always helpful.
Let's look at one aspect of that disruption routine, and that's staffing. We heard from Jim, who wrote on a WPR.org article comment section. He wrote, lack of substitute teachers is what forces school districts to go virtual. Jim says, I substitute in two districts in southeastern Wisconsin with a surge in cases. I've made the choice to quit exposing myself to the rampant spread of COVID. Fewer subs are willing to expose themselves to getting sick from COVID for the $100 to $120 bucks a day that most districts pay. Substitute teachers, we see the Cap Times reports, so the Madison School District having a record number of positive tests for staff over the last couple of weeks. How big a problem, John, is it just to have people in the schools to do the job?
It's a very big problem, and I think that's one reason that schools are making the decision to go virtual temporarily. I mean, what happens when there is one case in a school and that one person has contact with several people, you know, that means that you have to have a response. When one person gets COVID and one teacher gets COVID and they're out and many people have been exposed, you run into the challenge of people having to sort of quarantine or isolate themselves. And that's one of the reasons that the CDC recently reduced the number of days that people needed to be out of work or recommended to be out of work, because with the number of cases we're getting with Omicron, it's almost as if we quarantine for 10 days, the society will shut down, right? And schools are no different. So as this person has said, you know, coming to school, putting yourself at risk, and also putting others at risk is a choice that some people don't want to make. And that's in some ways, we've seen that happen in some of the major school districts in Chicago, New York, where there's conflict between the teachers union and district management and leadership, because teachers are concerned about being in these situations where their health is placed at risk and other people who are not obligated to be in school, substitute teachers, may make other decisions. So it's a fundamental problem for us to deal with.
You also mentioned the politics surrounding this here in Wisconsin. We have one likely Republican challenger for governor taking out an ad this week pointing toward the Madison and Milwaukee delays, saying, you know, they're attacking that idea, saying as governor, she wouldn't allow schools to do this. Could you talk about how much that that idea that politicians are looking over their shoulders is influencing school district decision making?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that happens in states like Wisconsin is you have competing ideas and competing ideologies that are coming into play. But I think one of the things we really have to pay attention to is we really need to be focused on the science. What is the science telling us about the consequences of closing and the consequences of staying open? And what we have too often is people playing politics with those decisions. For example, even having conversations about masking, social distancing, and vaccines has become a highly politicized set of issues, when in reality, we know that masks work, that masks can be protective, and that high quality masks can really mitigate the spread of COVID. We know that vaccines keep people out of the hospital. We know that they keep people from dying from COVID. But we have these contentious arguments and debates about vaccinations. And this is something that has traditionally been a debate that happens around vaccinations amongst a small set, a subset of the population. Most people to go to school had to be vaccinated against certain conditions and diseases. And so in the contemporary context, given the way that things started at the beginning of the pandemic and the sort of deeply polarized country that we live in, we can't even make decisions that are scientifically based without people spreading misinformation and creating arguments that are largely across party lines, Democrat and Republican.
This reminds me of the last time I talked to you about these issues. I think it was back in 2020, this lose-lose thing where, yes, being in person in schools is not risk-free. There are risks and consequences there. Not being in schools, there are risks and consequences to learning, maybe to social well-being for kids. How do we balance those two things out?
I mean, I think we have to have a discussion and conversation that is rooted in the best evidence that we have, right? We know that young people can go to school relatively safely with the proper mitigation strategies in place. The problem is when we try to put those mitigation strategies in place, they've turned board meetings into contentious battles over things like masking, right? And we also know that when young people are at home, there are some deleterious consequences that can happen. So the best thing for us to do, in my estimation, is to take the science seriously, try to figure out when it is prudent to keep young people away from school, which I actually think is prudent at this moment with the spread of Omicron, to keep people out of school temporarily because of the consequences of a spread in cases and what that means for disruptions that could be longer term. But we also just really have to attend to how do we do it safely and for people to go along with those mitigation strategies that are most effective.
Talking to John Diamond, professor of sociology at education policy at Brown University, looking at schools, a new beginning for the school year, coming back from winter break amid the Omicron outbreak, and some schools putting off in person for a couple of days, maybe more, a little bit of virtual, a lot of schools going in person, trying to get testing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think schools should do, especially maybe in your local area? If you have a stake in this as a student, parent, teacher, administrator, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, I know a concern you have is of unequal outcomes in schools, even in normal times when it comes to things like resources for schools. Are we paying enough attention to how particular districts, maybe in some of these big city districts we've been talking about, are affected by resources when it comes to dealing with this latest COVID surge?
Yeah, I mean, I think what COVID has done is it's shown a light on many of our cleavages in our society and social class inequality, racial inequality, and other forms of inequality have in some ways been exacerbated by the pandemic. And so it is important for us to pay attention to those things. There's been a lot of discussion about the loss of learning that happens for young people who aren't in school and how the consequences of that are greater for young people whose families are not wealthy, for young people in certain communities. So I do think it's really important for us to pay attention to those issues of inequality. But I will continue to say that, you know, I still believe that young people are resilient. I still believe that the loss of a few days of school or some period of school can be overcome. But the health consequences, I think, need to really be driving our decision making as much as possible. And we need to sort of create more effort to address the sort of inequalities that emerge. But I think the health consequences are really important for us to consider. And I also would just add to that, that I think we've, you know, unfortunately seen a failure in a number of ways in our society as a whole. First, to take the pandemic seriously. Second, to do the things that we needed to do to sort of mitigate the consequences. And most recently, to not allow our politics to overwhelm our common sense around some of the critical issues that we need to be addressing. So I think we, you know, kind of need a reset in some ways. We need to understand what we need to move forward. And that means across the federal, state, local levels, and our individual decisions, we need to be figuring out how do we move forward from this as opposed to continue to cycle in a negative direction.
Talking to John Diamond from Brown University, looking at how schools are coping with the Omicron surge just after winter break, some putting off reopening, most going back as scheduled. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should schools be open this week for in-person learning? What's been your biggest challenge in the last 2 years? The schools have gone back and forth between in-person and virtual learning. If you're a parent, what do you want to see happen? Has your district bumped back a couple days? What's that meant for your schedule, your work, your childcare? If you work in a school, do you want to be there? If you're one of those substitute teachers, are you maybe not taking those jobs for a week or two? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our talk with John Diamond, Professor of Sociology and Education Policy at Brown University, talking with us about schools coping with another COVID surge, with leaders including President Biden pushing in-person learning, some districts delaying reopening, starting off with a couple of virtual days along the way. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Especially love to hear from parents, students, staff at schools, what you're seeing, what you wish you were seeing. Let's go to your calls now. Rebecca is with us in Manitowoc. Rebecca, hi.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to comment or just offer some insight, I guess, on just the damage that's done when kids are kept home, because I have two children. Last year during the shutdown, we're both in high school, and when the school shut down and they became virtual learners, their grades suffered, and one of them actually became very depressed and suicidal, and we had to start counseling. And these are both straight-A students. Both my kids were straight-A scholarship students and were failing classes because that social life that they rely so heavily on just disappeared overnight. They're both in extracurriculars and sports, and everything that they hold dear and love disappears overnight. And I think, you know, the discussion is always about the grade school children, but let's talk about the high school children and what happens to them when we shut down classes. Most of these kids are close to adulthood. Most of them are vaccinated. Let's not shut down the schools and let's leave it up to, you know, masking and distancing and those sort of things, because I think it's way more damaging.
Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing that story. Best to your kids. Hope they've bounced back from that. John, what do you think? Mental health concerns, social and grade concerns from Rebecca and her kids?
Yeah, I think Rebecca's comments are really important to keep in mind. And there are consequences for young people who are out of school. And I know some students suffer academically my own son actually did well being out and thrived in certain ways, but I know many young people had serious struggles being at home, and the mental health consequences I think are important to keep in mind. I think we've all had some mental health consequences, even though we may not always acknowledge it. But I think another point that Rebecca made is really important, that we need to make sure that we're making in-person learning as safe as possible. We've had sort of a fundamental failure in getting testing, making testing available. We've had challenges getting people to do things like wear masks. We've had other kinds of challenges around, she mentioned vaccination, around getting enough people vaccinated to sort of keep the spread down. So I think, yes, we need to be aware of what's lost when young people are out of school, but we need to do the things to make it possible for them to be there as well.
Rebecca, thanks again for sharing your experience. We'll go now to Lauren in Madison. Lauren, hello.
Hi. I'm wondering, from Dr. Diamond's research, if he's done any research during these times around some of the effects of students, vulnerable students who, when schools are closed and parents have to go to work, what happens to those students, and do the health effects of going to school, is that worse than students who are left home alone without...
Lauren, thanks for the call. So kids who are at risk, who are home alone, John, instead of being at school.
Right. I mean, there is good research that sort of speaks to what happens to young people when they're at home. And, you know, those young people who are at home, who have substantial resources and may even have a parent who's home and can sort of help them with school, are definitely at an advantage. And those young people who don't have those things, there need to be some things put in place to make sure that they're not just at home and vulnerable. I mean, it speaks to larger issues and problems with regard to the sort of safety net that we have, the vulnerability of a lot of families in terms of having those additional resources, the ways we provided support for people who are out of work or struggling financially. So there are bigger issues that are driving these challenges. But I think, you know, the comments that people are making do point to the fact that we're in a situation where we don't have a lot of good choices. And I think what that means is we need to be as clear-headed as possible about how to make the damage, how to reduce the damage as much as possible, as opposed to arguing all or nothing, one or the other, or falling back on political ideology.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Patty joins us now in Birchwood. Patty, hi.
Hi. I appreciate this discussion. Absolutely agreed. This pandemic has shown us how little we have regard for a social safety net. I'm a substitute teacher up in Birchwood. I would love to go back, but the school district doesn't require masks, and it doesn't require their people to be vaccinated. And so I won't go back because I also work another job and I don't want to spread it. And my concern is that it seems to be that the people in authority are kowtowing to the biggest bully in the room. The politics is the people that are yelling and screaming and making death threats. And I really think in order to not have a civil war, authority at all levels of government are just caving. And that really, really scares me.
Patty, thanks for sharing your experience as a substitute teacher. John, do you see what she's seeing, school districts caving to the loudest voices?
Yeah, I mean, I think I do. And I think there are some things that, you know, leadership sometimes means that you have to go against what the loudest voices are saying, right? But we don't really see that at the federal level, and we don't necessarily see it at the state level. Instead, we see, I think, people trying to score political points to make the other side angry, fall back on political ideology, as I said before. And I think sometimes leadership means you have to to step forward and do what's best for young people, as opposed to doing what is best for one's political gain or one's own position as a leader, for example. But I think the points that she raised are vital for us to pay attention to.
Thanks a lot for that call. In our last just over a minute now, John, can you paint us a picture of what you see as the ideal right now, this first school week of January, of how a school is going to handle this?
I mean, I think it depends on the school context. Personally, I feel like every school should require masks because we know they work. I think the federal government and others need to sort of make testing more readily available. But for schools, I think they do need to decide what's best in their local context. And I think all of the mitigation strategies need to be in place that are reasonable to make sure that the spread doesn't get out of control. Because what winds up happening is you start getting a spread of cases and basically nothing can work. So in places where there's a concern about cases spreading really quickly, I think it makes sense to take a quick hiatus to go virtual. And then hopefully in the next 2 to 3 weeks, opening up will make more sense and be a more viable option.
And just briefly, do you have any hope that the political temperature will dial down a little bit on this?
I wish it would. I'm not completely optimistic because the folks at the highest level of government don't seem to be interested in governing. And that sort of trickles down and it affects all of the levels of government and all of our individual lives.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
John Diamond is a professor of sociology and education policy at Brown University, formerly with UW-Madison, co-author of Despite the Best Intentions, How Racial Inequality Thrives in Good Schools. He joined us today for a look at schools reopening or delaying reopening in some cases during this latest COVID surge. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your experiences in schools right now. You can email ideas@WPR.org, tweet us @CentralTimeWPR, and of course, follow reporting over at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, rural hospitals have been hit hard during these COVID-19 surges. Find out how they deal with the challenges and share maybe your own experiences. That's tomorrow morning at 7, and that's coming up here on the Ideas Network. Meet the new dog, different than the old dog. Two new dogs, actually. The American Kennel Club announced yesterday that we'll recognize two new breeds of dogs. There's the Russian Toy and the Moody, that's M-U-D-I. They're both pretty rare at this point. There are fewer than 800 Russian Toys in the U.S. and about 450 of the Moody here in the country. They describe the Russian Toy as small and loving. In dog competitions, it would be in the toy category. Makes sense. The Moody is active, medium-sized, and part of the herding category. Upon seeing pictures of the dogs from the AKC, an informed source describes both breeds as adorable. Teaching new dogs old tricks, this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, restaurants in Wisconsin cities are creating connections with nearby farmers. We'll find out more from the author of a new book about Madison restaurants and the personal connections formed between chefs and farmers. Now, if you're hoping to hit the sledding hills this winter, you can learn some science lessons along the way. Hopefully those lessons will be about physics, not anatomy, from those bumps and bruises. We've got you covered, and we can offer some advice that can help you avoid a blistering run like this. Holiday legend.
Going for a new amateur recreational saucer sled land speed record, Clark W. Griswold Jr.
Remember, don't try this at home, kids. I am a professional. Later, dudes. Later, Rip. Hang Penn.
Chris Stockdale is an associate professor and assistant chair of the Marquette University Physics Department. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for letting me join. Well, how you doing?
Good. Well, as I understand it, your usual work involves detecting signals from supernovas in other galaxies. What leads you to look closer to home for some illustrative physics examples on the hills?
Yeah, just kind of when you see the snow out there, you just feel like you got to go slide. So it's just something you got to... You got to look, you got to have the home covered as far as well as like the megaparsecs away.
Now, one key lesson, of course, it's all or a big part of this is friction. What kind of lessons can we learn about friction and avoiding it as we're going down the slopes?
Well, the friction's actually not too bad. What generally what's happening when you're sledding is you're kind of melting that little top layer of the snow. And so you're sliding on almost like a little layer of water between you and the sled and the snow. So generally the friction's pretty low, assuming it's pretty smooth. And then if you've got bumps or, you know, if you've, people have been down and there's lots of divots and you're going to have ice forming, and it's not going to be a little hard if you don't have that snowpack right there. So as long as you've got like a good snowpack there, you're doing fine. Once you start getting ice forming and all that stuff, then the sliding motion doesn't quite melt the ice as quickly as it does the snow. So then you're going to get some bumps.
So our best bet is to be the first one to hit the slopes after that fresh snow?
Yeah, be the first one to hit the slopes, or at least if you've got a, you know, depending on the kind of sled you've got, you can kind of spread that out a little bit. So if you've got like one of those toboggans, whether it's a wooden one or whether it's a plastic one, you know, they've got a big base along the bottom. And if you just lean left or right, you can steer. But yeah, that gives you a lot of coverage to spread things out. And you're not too, centered in. You want to have something that's pretty durable. Cause if you're not the first person to go down that hill, you want to, you know, you're going to hit some rough patches. And if you've got one of those bigger inflatables, you might be able to, you know, the vinyl ones, they tend to, they can be pretty helpful and, you know, kind of cushioning your bump a little bit, giving you a little bump. If you've got just a rigid sled, then you're probably going to hit those bumps. You're going to feel those bumps a lot more.
Now, suppose someone with, you know, more flexibility and younger bones than I have wants to catch some air. What's the spot we're looking for to get a jump?
Well, it depends on you're going to need a spot there where you can get a little bit of a ramp going up. Or some kind of bump there, but if you're like a moguls or something like that, if you're just going down a straight hill, you know, not too bad. But if you want the jumps, I'd go with something that's probably going to let you get up a little higher. So if you get, you know, probably not a big, you know, obviously not a big toboggan or something like that. Maybe one of those flexible flyers, the round ones, little discs. Those can get you probably some good bumps because you're limiting your contact. They're harder to steer maybe, but you know you're probably going to get a better chance of getting a lift than a longer, bigger sled.
Now, how about weight distribution? One big person or a couple people on a sled? Are we trying to spread out as much as we can?
I'd spread it out because if you're going one way or the other, you're going to snowplow somewhere. So if you spread it out, it makes it a little more even, keeps the force on all parts of the sled a little smoother, so you're not kind of likely going to lean. If you start having weight distribution one way or the other, you're going to start maybe tipping the sled either forward, backward, or left, right, and you want to be, you kind of don't want that unless you do a wipeout, which is fine.
Now you've got this is from a few years back, but you've got a video on YouTube of you explaining some of these physics lessons on a hill in Milwaukee, I believe. Do you have some favorite sledding hills in the Milwaukee area, or do you want to keep them secret so you can be the first one out?
No, I think there's a lot of good ones there. We were out at the one which is over there coming down off of Lafayette, I think, along the lake. Right near where there's coffee shops right across the street. That was a nice spot. Any spot where you've got a nice long slope down and you're not running into traffic or right into like a fence or something like that. Because you don't want to, as you were listening to the Clark W. Griswold there, you don't want to bottom out into the lakefront drive or something like that. That would not be good.
And you got to be honest with me here, Chris. As you're whizzing down a hill, are you carefully thinking about the mass and acceleration and the physics equations, or are you thinking about how you're going to stop safely at the bottom?
I'm just having fun. I'm hopefully that I'm just not going to crash somewhere. You get older, a lot younger, maybe you didn't worry quite as much. Once you start getting older, you're like, don't want to end up having to go to the emergency room this one. So.
Good lesson. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me join you. And hopefully in the next couple of weeks, we'll have a little more snow up there so we can go out and hit the slopes.
Excellent. That's Chris Stockdale, Associate Professor and Assistant Chair of the Marquette University Physics Department, talking with us about the science behind sledding. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story from 2019 about a unique ice fishing tournament in Luck, Wisconsin.
Classic Wisconsin winter activity is making its way into the world of high school sports. Ice fishing teams are popping up in schools across the state. Taylor Pomisol recently threw on her parka to meet some of the student fish wranglers.
It's the first high school ice fishing tournament of the year. Coaches are distributing bait. Student fish wranglers are driving out onto the ice via four-wheeler to find the perfect fishing spot.
It's one of those things that if you do it as a kid, you start to do it as an adult and you can carry it on. Mm-hmm. It's just one of those, you know, one of those things that a kid should get the opportunity to do.
For these students, winter means spending time outside for a more non-traditional high school sport. Wendy Dahlman is the president of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Fishing Association and the head coach of Prairie Farm. She says high school ice fishing teams started in 2012, but there are already more than 1,200 students and 100 schools involved statewide.
This sport is growing every year, so it's pretty cool to see. As you drove in, you could see the amount of trailers and trucks and buses and whatnot in the parking lots.
Though the high school competition is new, schools across Wisconsin are getting involved. Jack Springett is in his second year at Amory High School.
It's different. Nobody does it, so why not? It's fun.
And sophomore CJ Peterson is hoping Somerset's new team can make an impactful debut.
Hopefully you can do good this year. Hopefully you place in top 20 schools.
Preparation for the Saturday tournament starts the week before. Teams are packing and organizing bait, while organizers check ice and prepare prizes. On the day of the tournament, students get up early and head to the lake. Michaelin Christensen is in her second year at Prairie Farm.
I got woke up at 5:30, and I laid in bed until 6.
Prairie Farm junior Briley Hansen says the day starts with finding the perfect spot to drill and set bait.
You find the depth, bring it up a couple feet, set the minnow on, and then set the tip up.
Oh, guys, you got tip up.
The excitement and challenges.
You caught two already.
Don't stop until the fish are collected and the winner is determined. The season starts at the end of December and can go into March. Since the tournaments are on Saturdays, many students can balance their love of fishing and the outdoors with a school sport.
We're also in basketball, but this is like on the weekends and it's just a lot of fun. You get to spend time outside with your friends and a lot of time we just sit in a heated shack and enjoy fishing while warm.
Dolman says being on the ice can teach people about balance, conservation, and natural resources. It also gives students with different backgrounds a chance to compete together. Most teams don't require any experience to join.
Well, I had two girls out here that never handled an ice auger before, and they both drilled their own hole and set their own tip up. So,
parents are also encouraged to enjoy a day on the ice with their fish wranglers.
And what a great bonding experience for families to get out with their kids and you know, just be in the outdoors.
Christensen's dad, John Barthman, says the family's love of fishing and great memories on the ice make the cold Saturday mornings worth it.
Sometimes she teaches me, sometimes I teach her.
In the future, the sport hopes to expand throughout the Midwest and create more regional tournaments. A middle school component is being considered for the state.
That story was produced by Taylor Pomisol, a Wisconsin Public Radio intern based in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll find out how a city's restaurant culture can extend to the farmers and food producers that supply them. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. A city's food culture extends far beyond the walls of its restaurants. The connections between chefs, farmers, food producers, distributors, and customers are a big part of the character of a community. Our guest knows those relationships in Madison intimately and wants to help us understand why it matters where our food comes from. Lindsay Christians is a food editor and arts writer for the Cap Times and author of the new book, Madison Chefs, Stories of Food, Farms, and People. Lindsay, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, how would you describe the Madison food scene to people who are not familiar with the area?
I would describe the Madison food scene as being very connected to the farms that are around us. So one of the biggest influences on the chefs that I profiled in this book is the Dane County Farmers Market, which is the largest producer-only farmers market in the country. And the relationships between the chefs and some of these very specific farms are sort of, that's sort of what drove my interest in the book to begin with.
And you write that, you know, there was a big trend that came up on the coast some years back of this farm-to-table local food kind of stuff. It was kind of a natural for an area like South Central Wisconsin.
Absolutely. And I would say that the trend of farm-to-table, if we want to call it that, is it was almost simultaneous with L'Etoile here in Madison, Wisconsin. It came up right around the time of Chez Panisse and Alice Waters. So the connections were always there. I do think that the term farm-to-table has been a little bit greenwashed, which is to say you see a lot of people using it that don't really practice it anymore. But I do think that connection of, you know, getting things from this local food shed and then making really wonderful things with it is something that has very deep roots in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and you meant just use the word connection, and that seems like a real running theme in this book. It's not just this chef, this restaurant buys stuff from this farmer. They really seem to know each other, and they're talking about what are you growing or what cheese are you making or whatever. Can you talk about just some of those personal connections that are uniting, you know, countryside farmers and producers to these city restaurants?
Oh, for sure. So one of my favorite connections in the book is between Tammy Lax, who is the chef and the owner of Harvest, as well as the Old Fashioned in Madison, and Richard DeWild, who owns Harmony Valley Farm, which is out in the Viroqua area of Wisconsin. They've known each other for decades now. Tammy worked at L'Etoile before she opened Harvest, and she was the forager. So both, that means both literally and more, a little bit more figuratively, right? But she's a literal forager. She goes out into the woods and she'll find mushrooms and all kinds of wonderful things. But she also has this really close connection with Richard. So for example, if something happens to a crop where it doesn't turn out, or they have extra of something, when you have those close relationships between the farmer and a chef or someone who has a restaurant, they can say, you know what, you've got all these extra peppers, we can take them and we're going to turn them into, you know, this preserved thing, or we're going to turn them into a sauce that we can freeze. They can work together really deliberately. That was also very true for Underground Food Collective, which unfortunately is no longer, but had a huge impact in the Madison area just on, again, those connections between farms and restaurants, and then by extension, the diners who become more accustomed to seeing different varieties of peppers or a preserved garlic that is something where we have an abundance of a certain crop that we can then preserve for dishes long to come after that.
I'm really curious about, you've observed a lot of these chefs and their farmers at work. If I open a restaurant, and I'm not gonna, but if I open a restaurant, my specialty is broccoli soup, and I'm always gonna have broccoli soup, but that means I'm committed to getting broccoli, whatever the season, whatever the state is. How do these chefs kind of flex their recipes and change what they serve to say, hey, we're not always gonna serve the same thing. We're gonna serve the best that's out there right now.
So one of the restaurants that really worked with this in a really deliberate way is Salvatore's Tomato Pies. There's a Salvatore's in Sun Prairie is where they opened, but then there are also locations now in Madison and Monona as well. Salvatore's is a pizza place, right? So you can you have your sort of standard pizzas that you always are going to have. And Patrick DiPulo, who's the owner there, he knows that he's going to need X amount of this like locally milled flour, then also with other kinds of flour mixed in there. But he's sourcing locally on some of these core ingredients that he has. So like the burrata and some of the mozzarella cheese and things that they have there. But then what is actually on top of the pizzas, he has some that are really intensely seasonal, and you'll see, you know, more root vegetables or things like that in this time of year than you will maybe in other parts of the year. But he's using the pizza almost like a canvas. Like, this is a stable part of it, a consistent thing. But then what's going to go on the top of it, maybe he's going to use microgreens from Vitruvian Farms in McFarland, or he's going to use, you know, certain peppers or mushrooms or other things that he's either finding at the market or preserving. And I think having that consistent element, as well as the flexible element, is really important if sourcing locally is important to you and you happen to have a restaurant in the upper Midwest where it is winter a good chunk of the year. You really have to be flexible.
Talking to Lindsay Christians, author of the new book, Madison Chefs, Stories of Food, Farms, and People. We're talking about the connections that chefs make with farmers and other food producers and distributors. One story that struck me, Lindsay, and I think this is L'Etoile, a restaurant in Madison, in the early days, going out to local farmers, realizing our restaurant's too small to, you know, pay the farmers enough money to keep the supply going. So actually helping them make connections with bigger Chicago restaurants. It was in their self-interest to help other restaurants tap into the same source lines.
Yeah. The thing with local food and sourcing locally in a really deliberate and consistent way, you have to be, as we sort of said, more flexible. But then there's also the issue of quantity. So no one restaurant usually is going to be able to buy all of the squash that a farm grows. For one, like, it's all coming kind of at the same time or around the same time, right? So you also have to have other restaurants that are on board with that, on board with the unpredictability a little bit. Like, there's a chance that if you're a broccoli soup restaurant and all the broccoli, you know, gets a disease or is flooded out or something happens, right, that you have to be flexible that way. But also just being able to say, you're going to grow this many onions. We can only take this many because this is the size of our restaurant. So we need to have more of a collaborative, more of a collective commitment to supporting these farms and to saying that this is an important way of how we want to eat and how we want to not only develop but sustain a local food shed in that way.
How about on the farmer side of the equation, Lindsay? I mean, one way to farm is to do a lot of a particular commodity, whether that's milk or soy or corn or whatever, sell it to one big supplier, know that they can count on usually selling it to that one big supplier. Are there a lot of farmers out there willing to kind of custom make and mix and match for these local restaurants?
Yeah, so there are pros and cons of diversity, right? I think we know about the pros. You know, you have a lot of different kinds of things. If one crop doesn't work, you've got all the rest of your crop to rely on. But there are also economies of scale that it would be unwise to ignore. If you are really good at growing sweet potatoes, or you're really good at growing onions or something like that, it does make sense to do that really well. Say you're going to grow organic onions, do a lot of that. And that's, there's nothing wrong with that. That's not a bad thing. I know a lot of farms do CSA, and they talk about that as being like a master's degree in farming, because when you're doing CSA, you really do have to be pretty diverse. But a lot of the restaurants that relied on connections with restaurants, or a lot of the farms that relied on connections with restaurants these past couple years, have really had a tough go of it. So CSA has kind of come surging back over the last 2 years because of the pandemic. And I think we're seeing some of those relationships between farms and restaurants shift a bit, and also the value, you know, among diners and eaters for things like CSA go up because of, you know, the supply chain issues that are also affected by the pandemic, right? So I do think it's interesting to think about, if you can do something really well, like one thing, that's not necessarily bad. But making sure that we are sustaining the soil and the things that will allow that to be sustainable is also something important, I think, to keep in mind.
And just our last minute, Lindsay, there's a lot of talk about urban-rural divides in our culture. There's literally been a book written about resentment from rural Wisconsin pointed toward Madison. In looking at these relationships you track in your book, do you see this community that transcends some of those divides that are out there?
I think it does. I think there was a phrase that Therese Allen mentioned early on in our interviews about rooted cosmopolitanism. And I like this idea of us having roots that through these connections with farms, these restaurants that may be in urban areas can really make those connections, can make those kinds of relationships and to help us understand each other on both sides.
We'll leave it there. Lindsay, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lindsay Christians is a food editor and arts writer for the Cap Times. She joined us today to talk about her new book. It's called Madison Chefs, Stories of Food, Farms, and People. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, American democracy may be more fragile than we think, and intolerance could lead to authoritarianism. That's the message from the author of the new book, It Could Happen Here. And a lawyer who represented farmers in a high-profile lawsuit back in the 80s looks back on the case and says the deck is still stacked against family farms, but she says there are ways to push back. We'll meet the author of the new book, The Farmer's Lawyer. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then lawmakers on Capitol Hill are preparing to mark the first anniversary of the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol. We'll talk about that and a push to pass national voting rights legislation in Congress. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.